I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This episode, I watched Tiger King, y'all. So this episode, I'm going to talk about it, but I'm not going to talk about every single episode blow by blow. I'm generally going to talk about it because it's just something you'll really will need to watch yourself. Okay, so I don't know what week this is, week three of quarantining, or at least social distancing in Maryland and all of that jazz. And we're not the only state who is mandating, finally. Now, Governor Hogan has mandated that we stay home unless we're going to get groceries, gas, or go to work because we're an essential employee. And my husband is an essential employee, so he has, on the one hand, he has his uniform, and then he has paperwork too, just in case he's driving without his uniform, but he's still going to work. For whatever reason, he's got his paper, and we're being safe, and he's being safe, and all of that. But scary times, man. But we're gonna be okay. We're gonna be okay. Checking in with neighbors. And, you know, FaceTiming my parents all the time because, you know, they're in Missouri. And if I could take their temperature in the morning and in the evening every day, I would. And that's probably what being a parent feels like, or at least an overly protective parent. But what are you going to do anyway? And it's so interesting because, like, this is the time frame I had everything planned. This was the time frame where I was going to, and this might be TMI, but I'm just sharing it because this is life. This was going to be the time frame where I was going to, we were going to be doing some family planning, very specific, family planning. Come on, put two and two together. Anyway, but now I'm too scared to do that now because I don't know. Anyway, I'm not going to deal with that foolishness. So obviously I've been working from home because my job allows it. I'm blessed to have a job that allows it. And so, you know, but boredom makes you want to go out and things, right? And so you can get careless. So I'm continuing to keep the wipes with me and wash my hands and have the antibacterial stuff with me because you just got to be smart about it. But in the meantime, I can only go to the grocery store and get gas, but so many times, you know what I mean? I can only do that, but so much before you need to start thinking of other things. And I've also been having a problem overworking or working beyond my, end of the day. Right. So I'll start it a little early because I'm thinking about it now and I will end it a little early. My job, you know, my hours are 9 to 5, unless there's like a special event that I have to go to or something like that. Help our volunteers in a very specific way. And so, but for the most part, it's 9 to 5, but you know, I found myself starting at 8 something and ending at like 8 in the morning, something like that, sometimes even 7, and ending at 7:30 the other night, Anyway, the last week or maybe early this week, things are bleeding together. I remember looking at the clock and having to stop myself because it was 7:30 p.m. and I needed to stop because I was still working on something. Last night it was better, but I need to watch that because I wouldn't stay at the job until 7:30 unless it was like a very special project. I'm not working on any special projects. No special projects are happening right now. It's just regular because every single class is either moved online. So, and that work can be done during the day. And I just need better time management, but not even time management. I just need better measures in place because I've never had to deal with overworking to this extent. But I think because I'm home and I feel as though I'm not doing anything, I can do more work, which isn't a good thing because that leads to burnout. So use me as a cautionary tale. Don't do that. Because there was a time when I was younger and working in nonprofits, I know I've shared this before, but if anybody who's young and graduating soon, or who is not even young but looking for a career change, you can still overwork in the nonprofit field because you're working for a good cause now, and then your mind justifies it as saying, well, this needs to be done because I could be helping the end user in XYZ specific way. It's a trick. It's always a trick. Because at the end of the day, you still need that time for you. You still need to stop at 5 because the work will be there at 9 when you start it again, even if you're working home or from home. So that's just something I need to remind myself, because I tell all the little bright young interns that I work with, I tell them, listen, boundaries, maintain them. They're real. And start now, because when you get older, it's only going to be harder. The more, and it's not even relative to age, it's relative to the amount of time you spend in an industry, working in a cause. And a lot of the interns I run into and work with, they're going to be social workers, or they're going to work in some sort of aspect of human services, some sort of way, right? And so in that industry, it's too easy to overwork. It's like you don't want to be the person that just goes and collects your check and then you're out, because your work, the quality of your work could very well impact the end user in a way that is either positive or negative to an extent. It's not solely your work. It's yours and a bunch of other people's work. But nevertheless, you dragging your feet could impact negatively a person who really needs what you're working on, right? But you need to find that middle ground. You need to find that balance. And to be honest with you, there's not a whole lot of talk in the nonprofit world, especially to an organization. Girl, they're not talking about, oh, you need to make sure that you're not overworking, because that doesn't benefit them. That doesn't suit them. So this is how they do it. They either allow you to flex your time, which is a trick, honey, because let us be clear, flexing your time. How many of us listening to this, if you flex your time, let's be real, in a month, let's just say your work week is 40 hours, everybody's work week is 40 hours in the U.S. for real. I don't know what it is abroad. I couldn't imagine that it's different, but most people in the nonprofit world, your work week is 40 hours. You get paid 40 hours, but we all know that you're going to come in early. You're going to leave a little bit late. If there's a special event, you're definitely going to leave late. And so that flexing your time can be applied appropriately if you're not having to use it, if you're not flexing, if you're not overworking every day, right? But in the nonprofit world, there will be whole weeks where you're going to work 8-9 hours, eat probably more depending on what's going on. How are you going to flex that in a month? Or here's the deal. Some jobs will do you like this. You got to flex it within that month or you lose it, which is, I think it's illegal. I need to look into that. I need to go back to HR. Certainly nobody that I worked with, maybe I'm making that up. Certainly nobody that I worked with ever said that. But instead what would happen is you'd mess around and forget that you did all this overworking. And you'd flex some of your time, but you would not flex it all. You would never get it all back because you're always overworking. In my last job, which I've been thinking about lately because it's playing an integral part of this emergency response to COVID-19 here in Central Maryland. Well, shoot, across the state, but definitely Central Maryland. Anyway, overworking was too easy because, once again, if human services, we were doing something that our job could very well impact the end user, which was probably your auntie, your uncle, somebody that you could see in person, right? And so you get paid 40 hours. If you're salaried, you get paid 40 hours, 80 hours for 2 weeks. You did not get paid for 180, maybe near not working 100 over, but like maybe you work in 90 to 100, maybe you work in 10 to 20 hours over that 2 week pay period. You're not getting that back, and you're definitely not going to flex your time in a time like this. You're not flexing. You're not. You just not. And that's kind of one of those things where it's like on the one hand, how you going to argue, oh, I need my time in a time like this? but you definitely have to take a stand yourself. And it's incumbent upon organizations to make sure they have enough people to cover this. It's also incumbent upon the individuals to take that step back. Now, in a pandemic, do we really want to grapple? It's hard to say. But the thing about it is, there's always some sort of emergency happening in a nonprofit. I guarantee you, it never fails, depending on it does whatever's going on. There's always some special thing that's happening. And our society is built like, oh, do the right thing. Well, the right thing to whom? Do you know what I mean? What good does overworking do if you've worked so much that now you're beginning to make mistakes because you're not at your best? That's the thing. Come on. Like, sometimes we need to take a step back and be reasonable about this thing. And to be honest with you, when I was younger, I didn't have that in me because I was so zero focused on the mission and my part to play in it that you couldn't tell me to take a break because I was so into it. And right now it's going to be hard for people, especially people in the nonprofit world, but definitely, well, people in the nonprofit world who are, who can be justified as being an essential worker, but then also medical professionals. I don't understand that industry. I don't know much about it, except that they need mental health breaks too. They need body breaks as well. They need time too. And I just know that there are certain industries, actually every industry, because patriarchal capitalism. This society, the American society, is built on the it favors men and it favors capitalism, right? I can't say the phrase, but you know what I'm talking about. For some reason, I just can't say it this morning, which is when I'm recording in the morning. Anyway, what was I trying to say? Oh, so this society, it's like, it's male focused, as we know, but then even in that respect, you have to perform a certain way. And it's just built on who can work the hardest and look like they're working the least at the same time, look like they're impacted the least by working the hardest, right? Which is made up. It's not real. It's fake, right? We know that. We know that all those big time bosses in the 50s and 60s, 40s even, when this American society was being built on capitalism and patriarchy, we know, if we're living, breathing, thinking individuals and we're looking back into the research that's out about CEOs and things now, we know that they were experiencing very traumatic health issues, probably very serious mental breaks in some capacity. They were definitely violent in many cases, or had some had issues with either drug abuse or some sort of abuse of a person. We don't know that, we don't have proof that all of them have that, but it's when you overwork and when you overstress, and I might be reaching a little bit, but let's be real. When you overwork and overstress, you tend to lose aspects of reality, right? And so when you're used to getting your way, you get your way in every aspect of your life. And that's at home. That's at home and at work, right? And so what we know is that we've been overworking ourselves because it seemed like the right thing to do. And the people who've been overworked are rewarded. And the trade-off on that is the people who overwork now create this mythology that says, oh, well, I never needed a break. I never needed, no, all my relationships worked. None of my family or anyone felt neglected or misused in any way. Maybe I had an attitude. Maybe people thought I was mean, but they always respected me. They probably feared your baby. And where was I going with this? I guess my point is, our society is built, the American society and all of its nasty, nasty flaws, particularly has a really nasty flaw of trying to convince people that give all of yourself. And if you want something in return, or if you want to be valued in return, then you're scum. Because you're not doing this for the right reason. You should just give, right? And I think that sort of mentality really reflects itself in the nonprofit world, 100%. It reflects itself in the nonprofit world down to the volunteer, down to the volunteer. Of course, in the medical industry, you know, you're saving lives and there's a part of your ego that it's feeding, right? You're doing your part, right? Well, specifically if you're a nurse or you're a doctor, right? I feel like that ego piece is there. If you're not if you're in the medical industry, but you're not a nurse or you're not a doctor, I don't know what the ego piece is like. But, and again, this is me looking on the outside, from the outside looking in, because I have a few people who are either nurses that I know in my bigger circle are that are either nurses or doctors themselves. And so what I know is that there's an ego piece involved to it, right? And so that's what fuels you sometimes more than the money, and drives you to, if you're not careful, be careless with yourself and your time, right? But in the nonprofit world, it's that ego piece related to, oh, look at all these people that we've served, and oh, look at all these people that we've helped. And this was my part in it. Everybody's talking about their title and what they do, because that's an ego piece. It's totally ego, right? And so, yeah, we're in this period where even an epidemic, you should be thinking about making sure that you are taking time for yourself, because you're no good to a single person in the whole wide world if you are overworking yourself and you're sloppy, right? Or you're overworking yourself, and in my case, you're overworking yourself, and now you're becoming, you run the risk of becoming irritable on these meetings where you're trying to, you're on these think tanks, because everybody has a think tank at this point. And I can't tell you how many meetings I've been in where the resource that we're providing, someone is like, ooh, this would be great. Let us help you get the word out. I have never been a part of so many think tanks now in my life, in this position, in this role where I'm working now. Well, I have been working for the last couple of years. Where was this urgency to make sure that we were connected then? Well, it was nowhere. But now everybody wants to do something virtual, and everybody wants to appear as if they're helping, doing their part. So, of course, there's a sense of urgency to work together now. But before, it was like, oh, I'm gonna do my thing over here, and we all gonna do our things in our own separate little corners. So anyway, that's a gripe that I have. But nevertheless, that sense of urgency to be caught working is, I think, messing with me a little bit, because now I feel like I know I'm working too much because the role I play is very important, but it's not the most important. So let me not be clear, or let me be clear to myself. And so anyway, in an effort to, and that was a long, long way to get to where I'm at right now, but I'm here. And in an effort to be intentional about the time that I'm taking, even when I'm working from home, because working from home is just not my thing. It's not long term what I ever want to do. I will take a day, maybe even two a week, no more than that, because this is tough for me. This has been tough because I like to be around people. Which I never really thought I would say that, but it's true. I get my energy. I get a lot of excitement around interacting with other people. I'm a people person. I do need that time to just decompress from people, because people are a lot emotionally and otherwise. They're a lot, but I do get a lot of energy when I'm around other people. I feel like I can do things when I'm around other people. That's been difficult for me in this period. So, as in an effort to get some joy in my life and to make sure that I'm maintaining boundaries, work boundaries, which is a struggle for a person like me, I'm watching, you know, more things. I'm getting on IG Live and Facebook Live more, which is not something I ever did, because it felt like information overload for me. Because again, I get all my energy from going around, and I give energy from being around other people. And when I come home, I don't want all that. Sometimes I just want to surf Twitter and laugh at dumb stuff or read things, right? I don't want to interact with people unless I have to. And so this has been an interesting shift. So I've been pushing myself to watch more things on all those subscription services that I have, because I, like you, I'm quite sure, I have four. Well, you can't really count HBO because that's part of my cable package, but I definitely have three subscriptions to streaming services. I don't count HBO because it's a part of my cable package and I don't technically pay for it separate. But Hulu, what is it? Hulu, Amazon Prime, and Netflix, I do pay for. And so I've been watching those lately, and honey, I've critiqued down Amazon Prime before because those movies, honey, they look a little pale. The stories ain't that interesting most of the time. And it's a lot of rerun films and shows, right? So it's not technically, it's not always my thing, but there is a show coming on Amazon this week, next week. That's supposed to be an AI sort of thing. It's like a love story. And honey, let me tell you something. I have read so many through Audible and physically. I have read so many romance novels. I never thought I would be a romance novel type of woman, but here we are. Anyway, but yeah, Amazon is really up and down. Prime, she really up and down. But there's a show coming out whose name I can't call about this guy who dies and his consciousness is uploaded into this system. And a love story ensues between him in this new system and the operator or his assigned operator and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so I'll watch it. It'll probably be cheesy as all get out, but I'll watch it because it's like some of those romance novels that I'm reading. Fractured Souls. There's this really good book called Fractured Souls. Can't call who it's written by, but it's a sci-fi love story. And it's kind of cool because even though there's lots of romance in it, there's also like it's got the nerve to have a really good storyline. And I finished it last night and I was angry because I wasn't watching. I was listening to it on Audible and I wasn't paying attention to how many minutes were left, you know, the time frame. And I just knew the way it ended, there's at least another hour, but you see how they do. It's a whole book. It's a whole new book left in that series. So anyway, look how easily I get distracted. Anyway, so you know, Amazon hasn't really hit it out the park for me, although I'm looking forward to that movie that's coming out with that guy who uploaded his consciousness. Hulu, I've been watching Project Runway like no tomorrow. And I've been toying with Little Fires Everywhere or whatever that's named after that book. I don't want to. We'll see if I actually get to it. But it doesn't interest me. It really don't. It really do not interest me, to be honest with you. Because it gives me this weird... I don't know. It don't matter. I'm not into it right now. Anyway, you know, Hulu has... I tried watching the second season of Killing Eve. It got me so frustrated that I stopped. Because Eve is on my nerves. She is on my nerves. She's disrespectful to her marriage. She's disrespectful to her friends. The only people who give a darn about her, she's disrespectful to. And for what? This murderous piece? She trying to get on the side? Like, what's wrong with you, girl? Just self-righteous and I couldn't do it. Maybe I'll pick it up later, but I'm too angry about it now. It's just, how you going? I can't root for you, baby. And there's not a person in that show that I really want to root for. You supposed to root for Eve or... I forgot the woman's name, the Russian woman's name, who's supposed to be who's an assassin. The Russian woman who's supposed to be an assassin, she's not enough for me. I want to root for Eve, but I can't root for somebody who's clearly destroying all the relationships in her path to go after this one very destructive, she knows is destructive, relationship. That's not cute to me. That's not avant-garde to me. There are too many real life examples of people scorching the earth behind them in order to go after a relationship that they know wasn't going to work, and surprise, it didn't. So like, why do I want to finish watching Killing Eve? I'm not there yet. Maybe y'all love it. I'm not into it because it made me angry. Anyway, so, you know, I'm watching the seasons of Project Runway. And I think what I want to do, I just watched, season 9. And I think the person that won should not have won. and it was tacky, I think. It was interesting, but it was tacky. It was a woman from Trinidad. Like, they called her the beauty queen. I guess she was a part of Miss Universe or whatever. And she, like, won something. Her construction wasn't there for me. Not over the runner-up. And it just... I think they were pulling a stunt to make her... Actually, at the end of the day, I think all of these shows... These competition shows, some of them do pull stunts. And I think that was a stunt. Like, her clothes were cute or whatever, but like, they had more critiques about her clothes than they had about other people that were the finalists, yet they did not choose her. And I think what they did was that they were like, everybody up here at this point, y'all all got burgeoning careers when you go home. You don't need this show, but we want to make a statement. And so we're going to choose her. And I'm like, ew. And I hadn't gotten that feeling in previous seasons, but I definitely got it with that one. So anyway, I think what I'll do, though, is go back and look at the season that Christian Siriano was on. And I want to watch that because I can't remember his win. Did I say the show Project Runway? Anyway, I cannot remember his win, but I want to go back and I want to watch it because Christian Siriano of I think he's the only one. The only winner that has received whose brand has blown up in the years since he's been, he was the winner. You know who he dresses everybody. And the thing that the reason why I pay attention to him is because he dresses black women. And being real, let's just be real. Not every designer really knows how to play with color and what colors and I'm going to be honest with you. And I said that a minute ago, but I'm saying it again. Christian Siriano dresses Leslie, who's on SNL. He dresses her so impeccably. It's stupid. And it's not that I think she's super easy. It's just, she's tall. She's brown skin in a way that if you don't know how to dress a person that is brown skin, you go mess around and not, celebrate their chocolatiness, right? And not that she's like super chocolatey, but you get what I'm saying. Like, if you don't know how to dress people who don't look like you, who aren't pale and super thin, you can mess that whole thing up. That you can put a big girl in and sheer and make her look like, you know, she a package. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, you know, you can put someone who's average, but everybody's average in the real world for the most part, but average is relative, right? But like, you could put a tall girl in something that makes her look short. You can put a big girl in something that makes her look like a box. You can put a slim girl in something that makes her look like even more of a board. Do you know what I mean? Like, you could really mess it up if you don't know body types. And it's very clear that Christian Siriano knows how to dress women of varying shades and sizes, and he has clothing that reflects that. And that's not something you see every day, where you see somebody who is, unless they're big themselves or unless they're of color themselves, you really don't see a lot of white designers making clothes that really do fit everybody, because he's trying to get that coin from everybody. What you see is a lot of clothes that they say, oh, this will work for you, but it's a garment that's been made originally for someone who has been made in a size 8 or whatever, or maybe it's been a size 6, and then all they say is, oh, just blow it up and it'll work in a size 20. No it won't. You can't make a garment unless that thing is for real universal, which means that you have to be making it with universality in mind. And I'm not just talking about evening to day or day to evening. You know what I mean? Summer to spring. Do you know what I mean? Or summer to fall. That you can't make an outfit, or spring to summer. You can't make an outfit with you can absolutely make an outfit with the seasons in mind, but you sure can't make an outfit without being intentional about how this is going to look on somebody who's a size 4 versus somebody who's going to look, how they're going to look in a size 20. And let's be clear, you can't always shrink down or blow up outfits to make it look good on everybody unless you know what you're doing. And Christian Siriano looks like he knows what he's doing. So I'm going to find on Hulu, his season isn't on Hulu, but I'm going to find it and I'm going to watch it because I want to see his glorious rise. And I cannot remember what he was making before, versus what he made at the end, at the beginning of Project Runway versus what he was making at the end. And anyway, other than that, I'm not really into a ton of shows on Hulu. I know American Horror Story 1984 is on there. Not my thing. It's really not, because it reminds me of a bad horror film, and I'm not into it. So anyway, so I've been on Netflix. And Netflix has a ton of stuff. And again, just like Amazon Prime, it has its ups and it has its downs. I've been watching, you know, I skipped over HBO, but, you know, I've been watching all the shows. Of course, I'm watching Westworld. And at some point, I'll talk about that because, you know, Dolores is on my nerves, as per usual. And I've said that before. She is on my nerves. Anyway, but I do like season 3. Anyway, but getting back to Hulu or Netflix. So, you know, I told you I couldn't finish my block because gross. And that's just my opinion. I just couldn't do it. Maybe I'll go back to it because I like the little black boy. I've actually followed him on Twitter. I think just Twitter. Anyway, he's pretty funny. He's come up with some interesting videos these last couple of weeks. But I might have to unfollow him because maybe he's, you know what I mean? We'll see. We'll see if I continue to follow. Anyhow, but I'm just, I'm not in a place to finish on my block. And there are other films that have come out, other films and TV shows and stuff that have come out. But throughout these last couple of weeks, Tiger King has been recommended. It's been at the top of the page, just like it's been at the top of your page when you go to Netflix. But I've been avoiding it because everybody was talking about it. And if you've been listening to this show and the episodes for a little while, you know that I can be a little anti because everybody likes it automatically makes me not like it because that's who I am sometimes. It's real petty and it makes no sense. And I could, in theory, love the premise of the thing, but because everybody and their mama wants to watch it, sometimes I just refuse to on the strength of everybody else wanting to watch it. And I don't want to be a part of it. Do you know what I mean? I can't tell you the rhyme or reason. It makes no sense because do I watch blockbuster films when they come out? Absolutely. Did I run out like everybody else to go see Black Panther? You better believe it. Did I go and run out and see Birds of Prey? You absolutely guaranteed I did, right? But then every once in a while, there comes a show or a movie that I refuse to see. I refuse to see Titanic until this day. Refuse to see it. Will never watch it in my life. What's another one? Oh, The Notebook. Refuse to watch The Notebook. Will never watch it in my life. There's some others, but those are the two that really stand out because I made a stand when Titanic came out. I was young, real young, but I made a stand then. I was never going to watch it. The Notebook, I was a teen or 20 something. Can't call when it came out. Maybe I was a teen. I don't remember the year it came out. Anyway, but I remember strongly feeling like you got me messed up. I'm never going to watch this thing in my life. And guess what? Ain't watched neither one of them. Ain't watch it, ain't gone. Anyway, but so when I saw on my recommended Tiger King, I was like, I started to get that feeling like, you got me messed up. I'm never gonna watch this. But people kept talking about it in a way that was interesting. They were talking about it, but they were never describing it. Or if they did say something, they would be like, one of the lead persons, Carol, killed her husband. She did it. Or they would say, Carol did it. I know she did it. I know she did it. She did it. And I'm just like, okay, did what? She took out who? Who she take out? And I was just like, okay, everybody's talking about it, but it's intriguing what they're talking about. And so I watched the trailer the first time before I'd seen anybody talk about it on social media. I watched the trailer. And in that trailer, I was like, there's too much in this. It's too much happening. It's not straightforward. It's not direct. It's too much happening. So I'm like, maybe not. But then I started to look at all the people on social media, IG, and even Facebook to a certain degree, but more so Twitter, talk about how ridiculous And within the first 2 minutes of the first episode, how ridiculous this thing was. And I'm just like, it can't be that ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? Everybody tries to lead with something sensational, but it can't be that sensational in the first 2 minutes. It's probably going to be a dud. So I said when did I start watching this thing? I said on last Friday. I said, well, I guess I gotta on Facebook, one of them social medias, I can't remember which one. I said, well, I guess I gotta watch, I don't wanna watch Tiger King, but I think I have to. And people started commenting saying, you absolutely have to. It's a must. You absolutely have to watch this. And then again, that little prickling feeling of like, you don't tell me what to do, I'm not watching that, I don't have to. You know what I mean? Irrational, childish. But it came up, the feeling came up. But I did it already because some people said it's out of this world, hard to describe. There's so much foolishness happening in this thing. You just got to see it for yourself. It's foolish, but you got to see it for yourself. And so I just click play. And then within the first 2 minutes, my mouth was on the floor. But I dare say before the first 2 minutes, within the first 2 minutes, my mouth was on the floor. I said, what? No, huh? Here's the other thing that got me. There's this reporter that I think is for Fader. He's from Baltimore, and I think he splits his time between Baltimore and New York. And because, again, you hop on the train and you in New York and no time flat. You hop in your own car and you there again in no time flat because it's just how the East Coast is. Anyway, so he said, I follow him. His name is Lawrence Burney, I think. If you go on Twitter, I think it's Lawrence Burney. If you go on Twitter, let me see if I can try to find him right quick. But if you go on Twitter, his handle is his picture. This is a brown skinned man with some glasses and a bucket hat that's got Obey. It has the Obey logo on it. Hold on, Lawrence. Lawrence Burney. His handle is at True Laurels. True is spelled regular, T-R-U-E, and new word, but it's a run-on, True Laurels. So True, first word True, new word, capital L, lowercase A-U-R-E-L-S. Anyway, he works for Fader, and he's funny. And he's from Baltimore and unapologetically so. But anyway, so he said this one sentence. He was like, I take it back. You should be following Lawrence Burney anyway because he's just interesting. He says a lot of interesting things. He's funny, but not like he's not a comedian. He's just observant. I'll say that he's observant. But anyway, either him or somebody else I'm following said, you mean to tell me, or maybe it was Kid Fury from The Read. Shoot, it was probably Kid Fury from The Read. There's a person in this documentary who is a subject, one of the subjects of the documentary, for which the documentary is named, in fact, Tiger King, called himself the Tiger King. Married two straight men. Sounds ridiculous because it is, but it's true. And not only did he marry two, he married a third. Sounds ridiculous. Well, I don't know about the third. Well, the jury's out on the third. And I'll get to that. But he initially married two straight men and was living in a married polygamous gay relationship. I guess that's the thing. Because, you know, however you love, that's not my business. That's not my ministry. My ministry ain't to tell you how you're supposed to do. That ain't my ministry. But it's just in the middle of Oklahoma, this openly gay man marries two straight men. And that drew me right in. Now, there's something to it because it's not love for love's sake. There's some stuff there. And I'll get into it because there's a lot of stuff that troubled me about this that people aren't really talking about. because the documentary itself is so outlandish and out there that there's a predatory theme that is not just in the principal subject. It is literally in every subject in this film, in this show. This is a documentary full of predators, and that's what I'm going to talk about today, and other aspects too, because there's just so many layers upon layers of foolishness. But when you peel those things back, this is a study in predators and different types of predators. And we're not talking about the cats that this documentary is focused on, is based on. We're talking about the people. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today. In this episode. So when I come back, I'm going to talk about Tiger King. So let me tell you what I mean by predators. So, and I'm only going to focus on three of the characters, even though there were subjects, even though there were 6 central subjects and 2 minors, maybe even 3 minors. Whatever. I'm going to focus on these big three. And the big three, obviously, are Joe the Tiger King, Doc Antle, and Carol. I forgot her last name, but anyway, Carol. And if you Google it, you know what I'm talking about. Who I'm talking about if you haven't watched Tiger King. So, a couple of layers. And I said it in the intro, or I kind of alluded to it in the intro, but there are... The predatory behavior in here is so varied that there are whole layers. So let's start with, it's like they went back and forth. And then be honest with you, the documentary was a little bit harried. It was a little bit, it wasn't even disjointed. It just felt like it was frenetic a little bit. Like it would start with this story and then it would pop to this person. And then this would expand to something else. And then this would unravel to something else. Almost as if it was peeling an onion and all the layers, but like you needed to keep all the layers in place just to make sense of what you were looking at. I don't think the documentary was bad. I just think there was a lot of information shared. Anyway, so who do I want to start with first? I guess I'll just start with the titular subject. Joe Exotic. Joe Exotic was a openly gay man who also is a narcissist. Very huge ego, very self-centered. Toward the end of his spiral, before it led to some serious trouble for him, he kind of took his mask off. So whereas maybe you or I, if we wanted glory for something, we would like imply it, and maybe we would, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, that somebody really ought to be paying attention to the fact that this spectacular thing that's happening is because I put in some work. Do you know what I mean? Everybody has a little bit of ego in any situation, in any given time, right? But this guy, his ego is like on 1,000, right? And so his personality becomes this personality that he created called Joe Exotic. His name is something else. But anyway, so here's this openly gay man, very flamboyant in his own unique way, in that he's got a mullet, a blonde mullet with dark roots. He walks around in like shiny shirts, but always has a gun on his hip and is always running around with exotic animals, right? And so starts his life out making it seem as if he was a conservationist of sorts, right? And then it kind of devolves into this thing where has this animal show where he's showcasing big cats, but he has a whole bunch of other different animals, and he's specifically surrounding himself with people who are hard on their luck or no one else is giving them a chance, so that he can thereby look as if he's their savior and engender a whole lot of trust and loyalty, because who was there with you when nobody else was, who gave you something to eat, who gave you a place to stay when nobody else would, right? So you're going to take this crap I'm shoveling on you. You're going to take me talking down to you. You're going to take me throwing you in this, making you sleep in this trailer that doesn't, at any given time, won't have running water or a working toilet and is bug infested. You're going to stay there and you're going to work like a dog to tend to these animals because you want to be close to these animals. And more so, you want to be close to me because I helped you when nobody else would. That was what I got the sense of Joe being. That was his persona. But then he had another layer to him, which was, so he was very sexual being. And so not only is he gay, but he wants to engage in a romantic relationship. But what does he do? He doesn't engage with people the way you or I would in going on dates and you know, going through the process of getting to know a person. No, he, and I'm just putting it real, real blunt, he targets young people, specifically young boys who are in a bad way, and he showers affection on them, much like a predator, grooms them in many ways to be who they wanted, he wanted them to be, to the point where he literally took people in the documentary. He said that Joe convinced two straight boys to marry him and be his husband. And it's true that he was in a polygamous relationship with two men who were at least 20 years his junior, right? At least 20 years when the relationship began. And what it was probably more like a couple of things. These men, young men at the time, had issues with becoming who they wanted to be. One of them had serious drug problems. The other one, they alluded to the fact that the other one had drug problems too, but that he quit. So in essence, both of the young men that he engaged in a polygamous relationship with had drug issues, which is not to say that he made them do things. I think it just, they kept touting, and even Joe himself said, I married two straight boys. I'm attracted to straight men. I don't think those, again, sexuality is very, not again, but sexuality is very fluid. I think it was less like he took advantage of these boys and young men, and more like these young men engaged in a relationship with this person that they fell in love with because they fell in love. He put the razzle dazzle, like every predator does. He put the razzle dazzle on them, and so they fell in love with him. Now, does that make them gay? No, not necessarily. Does that make them bi? Maybe, but does it make them just someone who is enamored by someone who puts the razzle dazzle on you and makes you feel wanted and gives you the things that you need? And and alluded to in this instance that he fed those two young men with drugs. So did they enter into it with their own free will? Sure. But were they egged on and encouraged by his charisma and by the fact that he was supplying them with the drugs that they wanted? Sure. That had a big part to do with it. But to say that they were out and out straight men that he tricked, I think that's dangerous and silly and not the truth. But nevertheless, he's a predator. Because this is why he's a predator. Because not only did he keep them drugged up, as any controlling person would, to keep pets around, essentially. Because that's what predators do. They keep things and people around as things. And so he kept them drugged up and loved up and isolated them. Ooh, which is a big part. He isolated them. There was one point in the documentary that one of his husbands, he wouldn't let leave the compound, the compound where they were keeping the big cats. And everybody knew it. Everybody that worked there knew it. People that knew Joe knew it. And they just kind of let it be. And there was one point where Joe was like, well, you know, I got my thing going on like out here, just like Doc Antle has his thing over in South Carolina. And I'll get to Doc Antle in a minute. But nevertheless, so Joe engages. He has a intimate relationship with these two men. And it's very clear that coercion is involved and there's some free will, but it's mostly they're being exploited. Like, he exploited their love and their affection for him and made them feel emboldened to him just like he did his staff. it's remarkable. It would be remarkable if it wasn't so sad and downright abusive what he was doing to the people in his circle. But nevertheless, that's what he did. And so much so that one of the young men that he was in a relationship with clearly spiraled out to the point where he became more dependent on drugs. He was taking more drugs and in doing so, taking more risks. And there was a point where Joe was running for office, or maybe he was running for some sort of office. I think it was the mayorship at the time or the governorship at the time for Arizona. And the young man, either jokingly or trying to mask it as a joke, put a gun to his head that the person that he was playing with thought wasn't loaded. But the thing was loaded with one bullet, and he pulled the trigger and took his life. And Joe was distraught. Everyone was distraught. And, you know, they have a funeral. Joe brings out the family. And at the funeral, Joe breaks out into a song. Now, if you've been to homegoing services, Black homegoing services, anybody's, there's always a song. Somebody's always singing because songs are beautiful. Songs are soothing, right? But this song was weird because he was saying raunchy things about, before he sang, he said raunchy things about the young man. And then also he just, the song, it just felt like it was about him and not about the young man whose life is lost, right? And so the family's sitting up in the front like family do. And I'm seeing the mother lose it, but not for the same reason that you or I would lose it. I think she's just like, this is a spectacle. And she said as much in the documentary, because certainly the documentary and got her opinion on it. And anyway, and not 3 weeks later, this man is engaged in another relationship with another young man who he's put the razzle dazzle on, who regardless, he's not tricking these people. He's picking them. He's picking them like any other predator would. Right? And so let's focus on that. And so the sexuality of these young men, I think it's clear that there's an attraction there. Whether or not you want to put a label on it is only the business of that young man, right? But the reality of it is, this is a predator. 3 weeks was, no, was 3 months, sorry. 3 months after his husband, one of his husbands dies, you just pick you another one that's around the same age as your husband, around the same age as the other ones that you picked, because you got a type and you got an age, right? So he's doing all of this and still carrying on. And then, of course, his outlandish behavior takes it to a legal place, and then he gets in trouble for embezzlement and other things. And, you know, there is an accusation that he was convicted for, that he puts a hit out on Carol. And I'll come to Carol in a minute, because let me tell you, I got a lot to say about Carol. But let me switch gears. So I told you a minute ago that there was a point in the documentary where Joe Exotic said, well, I'm doing my thing here, and it's no different than what Doc Antle is doing in South Carolina on his ranch. So in South Carolina, there is this person who calls himself Doc Antle. He ain't a doctor or nothing. He ain't no doctor, but he calls himself Doc Antle. And he has a zoo, a private zoo, basically, and he's showing big cats and other animals and things. And honey, when I tell you, he's got, again, this, they charge, the reason why some of these zoos are so popular is because if you got the capital, you can get these baby big cats, talking about lions and tigers and ligers and all sorts of big cats you can think of, pumas and all of that, right? Leopards. And if you get them when they're babies, you can charge so much money per hour for people to come see them. And because in the United States, the only opportunity that we would ever have to be close, we would never get an opportunity to be super close to any of these animals like some of these private zoos. Because in an actual zoo, you have feet between you. You have cages and feet between you, right? Keeping you from the animals. But in these private zoos, they're literally bringing you the baby versions of these big cats and putting them in your lap. So people pay buku dollars for that, right? And so they get big dollars. And so Doc Antle, his compound is huge and sprawling in South Carolina. I think it's just outside of Charleston. Anyway, and he's got the, his way of keeping people around him is a little bit different, a little, but not by much, than Joe Exotic. He still knows how, he knows how to pick them, just like any predator would, except his, the most of the people that he picks to keep his zoo, his private zoo, are young women. And he picks them just like Joe does. He takes them, he gives them an opportunity. Hey, you know, sells them on the razzle dazzle. Hey, we're conserving these species, and we're, you know, we're creating a better home for them. They're not being abused and blah, 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 and blue, blue, blue. And his place looks better than Joe's. Let's be real. His place looks better than Joe's. And he's got these women walking around smiling and all that, ear to ear, and giving them the, you know, the what for in terms of, you know, showing, giving these paying customers a good experience and all of that stuff. And yet the underlying thing is Joe likes young women. He does. He likes young women, and he likes a type of young woman, or not even young. He likes a type of woman. And so he's got it where he essentially has, he gets these women. He's not even attractive. But again, I guess if you're charismatic, you don't have to be. If you speak in the language of a particular person and you know how to talk to them, it doesn't matter what you look like. It's just that you have this confidence and that you got them. And so we hear about Doc Antle and the fact that this man, he's got three women that he calls the ladies of his life, and they have separate houses and they do their own different thing. And it's polygamy. It's a polygamous relationship. And again, I guess if you are in a plural relationship and everybody in there understands what's happening and everybody has the power dynamics, you found a way to make that cohesive. I'm not knocking that. But what I am knocking is when one person has the power, which is what happens with Joe Exotic and what happened with Doc Antle. When one person has all the power and they dictate what you wear, when you sleep, what you do, that's not a plural relationship. That is a subservient relationship. That's not even, that's not a relationship at all. That's them controlling your life. You have no agency there. And so it's no surprise that when we hear of someone, a young woman who left the operation after working there, what, a year and a half? She said, oh yeah, it was implied that if you wanted to move up in ranks and get better positioning and get better opportunities at the camp, at the compound, that you needed to sleep with Doc, right? That you just need, and you needed, and here's the other thing. He made her get a body modification. He made her get breast implants. And the way she described it was so doggone pitiful, because she said, you know, it was one of those things where it was scheduled for me to do. And I work 12 hours at the zoo. I work 12 hours, sun up to sundown and beyond. And I'm always tired. I barely have any food. There are bugs and things overrunning my little sleeping quarters. I'm sleeping in essentially, which is a small dorm. And, you know, it's not much different than the conditions for the workers that was described at Joe Exotic's place. But, yeah, so she's like, there was nothing for me to pull out a loaf of bread in my little place and see it crawling with bugs. And I just had to throw it away and start over. I was always hungry. I was always tired. And so when it was decided that I was going to get body augmentation, in her case, it was breast implants, it wasn't one of those things where I fought it, because even though it wasn't my choice, it gave me an opportunity to take a break. And I mean to tell you, you would rather get a body augmentation and the pain that you would have to endure for that, just so that you could catch a break from the back-breaking, grueling work that you would be put under. And oh, by the way, they got paid $100 a week. And I can't remember what they got paid. I can't believe what they got paid at Joe Exotics, but it was probably that or even a little bit less. At Joe Exotics, they were scrounging for food from the food that they were feeding the big cats. And it wasn't much different at Doc Antle's. And so I'm just thinking, this man is a predator. And people are laughing at it. And one of the other, there was a big cat safari type owner from Ohio that was remarked in a conversation that he was having with Doc Antle. He was like, they were trading industry secrets, I guess. And the guy was like, well, don't tell me how to Don't tell me how to, I don't care about how you, you know, get the best deals for cats and how you get all of these animals. I want you to tell me how you got these women trained. He literally said that. I want you to tell me how you got these women trained. He's got them trained because he knows how to pick them and he knows how to manipulate them. That's what I mean. He knows how to manipulate them and abuse them emotionally, probably physically, but we don't have that data. We don't, you know, allegedly. But what we know is that these women are, he's taking their agency from them and he's manipulating them. A predator, right? Clear predators, right? But then there's one more predator that I want to talk about. And it's the person that on the face of it makes it seem like she's going after Doc Antle and she's going after Joe Exotic for the right reasons, because they're terrible. They have these, they're holding big cats, and big cats shouldn't be in zoos and private zoos. They should be in their natural habitat. But if they can't be in their natural habitat, at least put them in a conserve where they are actually being supported and not exploited and loved. This woman has a nonprofit, and let me tell you, as a person that lives in a nonprofit, let me just tell you right now, if you find the right road, the right lane, you can get money for just about anything in the nonprofit world, because a lot of people love, corporations and individuals love giving to organizations that make them feel better. And if you find a cause that makes somebody feel better about themselves, that if they just contribute to you, you can do all the heavy lifting and thereby absolve them in some small way of them having to do more work to make this world a better place, they're all for it. And that is a very bleak way of looking at nonprofits, but there is a whole segment of our global community that thinks just like that. If I throw a few dollars at the problem, I'll feel better and I'll just leave y'all to do the work, right? And so Carol, she found her niche, man. She initially started, as the documentary says, she initially started as someone who was breeding big cats. And she had whole videos sharing with people how to breed big cats. Now, keep in mind, people do change. And what you say when you're in your 20s may not be what you believe when you're in your 40s. And I appreciate change. I appreciate that. But this woman, she established a non-profit, and so she has workers working just as much to maintain her sanctuary as Doc Antle and Joe Exotic. The difference between those, between Joe and Doc and her, is that she don't pay them a dime. It's all volunteer work. And these people run to it and they love it. They run to and love it because volunteers, duh, that's what they do. Volunteers do work for free. Here's the difference. These volunteers actually think that their work matters because they're making a difference and they're making a better home for these cats. Now, here's the problem. When you look at her compound, even the little bit that she showed us, that's not a whole. She said that one lion needs 40 acres to themselves to roam. She didn't have 40 acres per lion. She didn't have no much acres per big cat. They look, the cages to me, and again, this being 100% fair, just it looked, I was only looking at it from the documentary's perspective, but it looked not much different than what I saw at Doc Antle's place and Joe Exotic's place. And she wasn't paying her workers. They were all doing it for free and they were doing it gleefully, which is what you get at nonprofits. And if you have a nonprofit that's doing it right, it's mutually beneficial. Nonprofit is doing the work. They're in the weeds and they're getting it done. And in order to get it done, they need volunteers who will sacrifice of their time, but so much to really help them meet that mission. And in turn, the organization is treating them right. They're giving them bang for their buck, in a sense. In essence, you're giving me your time. I'm going to make sure that you feel good about the work that you're doing. And I'm sure Carol is working them. I'm sure she's, you know, saying everything that she needs. But this is my problem with nonprofits. It's so easy to get people in nonprofits who don't mean any good, who think they have the moral high ground, but they don't. I don't see Carol's reserve any differently than I see Doc Antle's or Joe Exotic's. And at the end of the documentary, we know that Joe Exotic's Joe Exotic's compound was
bought by someone else and then it was being raised to be moved to someplace by a casino. Because at the end of the day, it's all about making money. Oh, by the way, Carol makes a whole bunch of money because, again, she gets a bunch of donations. But my thing is just like, if you're getting all these donations, why aren't these spaces bigger? Why don't you have more space? Why don't you have some more space? And what are you doing? If you can't return them to, like, she's doing legal things, right? She's going after it on the face of it to say, oh, we shouldn't be able to do this. You shouldn't be able to get big cats. And so, because that's the whole reason why places like me exist. Fair point. Got you. Cool. Meanwhile, back at the ranch though, baby, if your point is to put a lot of these private zoos out of business and create more sanctuaries, are you expanding your place so that, girl, you're going to need the whole state of Florida because she's in Florida. You're going to need the whole state of Florida in order to appropriately house these animals as you described. And again, I'm only seeing what the documentary showed. So clearly she's already at the end of this when, you know, within 2 weeks of it being shown on Netflix, she's already, you know, speaking out against how she's being portrayed. And I understand it because I would be mad too if I had no control over how someone portrayed me and the work that I do and it wasn't in a positive light. Here's the other thing with her. Her first husband vanished mysteriously and the day in the state of Florida, before you can declare someone dead, they have to be missing with no trace for like 3 years. And apparently, according to the documentary, on the day of three years to the day of his disappearance, she filed to have him declared dead. Here's the issue with that, or the reason why that's a big deal. He was loaded with money, loaded. And so thereby she inherited all of his money except for what was left in a trust for his kids. And because I guess she felt like that was the right thing to do. And she even said that in the documentary. But many people close to her first husband think that she had something to do with his disappearance. She said that he was suffering from Alzheimer's and that he had taken a private plane that he had tried to fly before and had crashed one before. And then he got into another one and he probably crashed over the ocean. I think that's a full-fledged story, and it's one that you can't corroborate because what can you find in the ocean? Not much, because it's so vast and it's so big, and currents sweep things all over the place. And even if you could pinpoint where he went down, that's no guarantee that the plane would still be in that same space. So it sounds convenient. Now, I don't know if the way I feel about Carol is influenced by this documentary, and certainly about her involvement with perhaps her involvement with her husband's disappearance, her first husband's disappearance. I don't know if the documentary is swaying that to me or for me. I just think it's awful curious. And I also don't like her methods, because the other piece of this is it just seems like she thinks she's morally superior to Joe and Doc because she's not operating in that same way. But I don't see much difference. She's still getting over on people. I don't understand exactly. Maybe I just need to look into what she's doing, and that's a fair point. But based on what this documentary showed, I am not moved that she is much different. I just think she doesn't like the comparison. But we have a big cat problem in the United States because American culture wants you to get anything that you want. And I remember growing up in the country, and I remember every time around Easter, there would always be an excess of bunnies. Now, I lived in the country, so, you know, what can I say? But I definitely remember knowing that one of my friends who was really who wanted to be a veterinarian at the time we were in high school, remarked that at her internship, she said around Easter, after Easter, there was always an influx of white bunny rabbits. And then I can remember my dad saying that, you know, after 101 Dalmatians happened, he can remember that people from the city would come to the country, and this is a real thing, at least in Missouri, would come to the country and then dump Dalmatians, just dump them. And if it wasn't Dalmatians, it was some dog, because people tend to, in the city, they tend to drive to the country and dump dogs. It's like a thing. In the United States, in the country, that's what people do. They either take them to the humane center because they don't want them no more because they're not cute and fuzzy anymore and little, or they dump them. Whatever the animal is, cats, dogs, anything, snakes, they'll dump them because it didn't match. They're no longer cute and cuddly like they wanted them to be. And the same is true for big cats. People will get big cats. And this is the documentary reminded us of this. People will get big cats because they're little, and they saw it on TV that this animal trainer was, you know, expertly handling this little animal, and it's going to be just like that when I take them home. And then it's not, and they get too big and unruly to handle them, and then they send them somewhere, they ship them somewhere, and then you have predators of all sorts. People who want to make money off of them will buy them and get as much money as possible. And then in many cases, another reason why this is bad is that in many cases, many of these private zoos are euthanizing these animals, not because something happened to them, not because, you know, they're deathly ill, but because they're no longer convenient. And so there are laws springing up against them. And I'm sure you've seen documentaries or watched or listened to podcasts about this phenomenon, especially the one in, was it Ohio, where the guy said, if you lock me up, I'm releasing my animals, I'm gonna kill myself or something like that. And that's exactly what he did. And it was so many cats and so many big animals of all kinds that he let loose on his property, and they got out in the road and stuff, and they were wreaking havoc because he was petty, right? But at the same time, there were no laws to stop him from getting all those big animals because he could. And so I appreciate that there are legislations being put in place to stop that. But at the same time, I'm just like, in this documentary, everybody is nasty, including Carol. She's not clean in this. She's gross. And I'm just, the predatory behavior, the fact that this documentary really didn't talk much about the predatory behavior in all of them is weird to me. But at the same time, there were so many things that they were trying to handle that it was hard to keep up. But the thing that stood out to me the most was the fact that there were so many people in the wake of all of these big personalities that were harmed in some way. And that's the thing that hurt my heart. And the fact that it just reminded me that nonprofits in the hands of somebody who just doesn't care are weapons more than tools for changing the situation of a community. Anyway, but yeah, you should watch it. There's so many more details I left out, like a ton of details, ridiculous details that I left out because I just didn't want to focus on that. But you should, and you should watch it if you've got Netflix or you can borrow somebody's account. Definitely watch Tiger King because it is interesting. Anyway, I also watched a movie that I think I'll talk about. It's maybe next episode. It's called Every Time I Die. It's really interesting, really interesting. And maybe I'll talk about it. Maybe I won't. But anyway, I hope you're well. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to leave me a favorable rating on all the places, CastBox, Pocket Cast, Google Play, Spotify, Apple Podcast, all the places, Radio Public, all the places. I appreciate you for leaving me a favorable rating, sharing the episodes with people you know who might enjoy it. Because again, at the end of the day, that's how you're going to expand the reach of this little project that I'm doing and have been doing for a little while now. And if you want to leave me a donation, that's cool too. Even 99 cents will be a helpful contribution. But for now, just once again, thank you for listening. Until next time.